Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to U.S. Tradomine. And today we're going to begin a new show. It's called, what is this show called? Time for a Plan. We don't know if we're going to keep that. It was just something that we threw off the top of our head. But this new show on Tuesday is all going to be about a clear and defined objective, something that we can actually say this is the goal. And then from the show going out from there, we're going to be discussing that plan and how to get and how to achieve that goal, how to be able to gauge our success, so forth and so on, and all the elements leading up to it. We'll be laying that out now. And while we're doing that, I would ask you to do something. Keep in mind the Constitution. Read the document that we're talking about, the U of Tredemy document, the petition, if you want to call it that. It's not a petition, it's a demand. But nobody understands demand, so we just put the petition in there. But look at it. Read through it. It's footnotes and reference as well, so go to the parts of the Constitution or the reference points and read about that. Find out what we're saying. And as always, question things. During this show, it's going to be important to know a little bit about history as well, and we'll cover those areas. So, sit back, enjoy the ride, and let's begin this trip. Gary wanted to open up with something, so we're going to turn it over to Gary. How are you doing, Gary?
Just fine. How's everybody this evening? Good. Glad to hear you're all okay. Back in 1993, when I left Waco, actually, before I left Waco, on the April 19th, 1993, my brain felt fried. I could not believe, I had trouble accepting that the government would murder people in their own home and in church as they did, and the frustration was unbelievable. And I, on many radio stations, declared war on the United States. I pointed out that it's the Cold War, but someday it's going to go hot. But it was a frustrating feeling, and since that time, I have seen little to indicate that there is anything, any way a peaceful solution can achieve restoration of the Constitution. Now, I traveled around the country for 2 years, met a lot of people in a lot of places, and everywhere I went, people kept saying, some people, some felt like I do, that there was no peaceful solution, but those that believed there was a peaceful solution said, there's a peaceful solution. And so I'd ask them, what is it? Well, we've got to vote these people out of office. Now, this is back in 93, 94, and 95 when I was traveling around the country. Oh, 15 years, and we still can't get but maybe a couple people that might believe in the Constitution, and we've made no progress at all. But other people said, I have other plans. I have other plans. I have other plans. And I keep laying them, asking people to lay them out. Some have talked about getting involved in the precinct politics where you get to select candidates. Well, that might work in a rural community where you can get some guy up there that believes in the Constitution. But when you get to the population areas, the ones that have the greatest impact, Los Angeles, Detroit, well, maybe not Detroit, New York, the major cities where all the votes are, the party's going to put all the money they can in to keep you from getting a good candidate in office. So nobody could ever come up with a good solution, a peaceful solution for getting the country back. I kept asking everywhere I went. Now, I slowed down for a number of years, and a couple years ago, when the economy started going south, one of the first pages I got involved in was Restore the Republic. Now, I've gone to hell since then. I can't even log on and stay logged on, but I met a couple people there that I've developed some pretty strong relationships. One of them happens to be the host of the show tonight. What's his name? Randy. Yeah, that Randy guy. And we got talking one time, and we were talking about peaceful solutions and whether there is one. And I pointed out that I'd been asking all these people, but I think in one of our conversations, I started wondering, did I ever ask myself that? And so in subsequent conversations, we came up with an idea. What if we look at what is the possibility of a peaceful solution. Well, at the same time, studying a little history, and I think the Founding Fathers left us the roadmap for restoration of the Constitution because they started from scratch and achieved what we have had for these past 200-plus years. One of the elements that they used back in 1774 there were, and 1775 with the Continental Congresses, there were a lot of people that wanted to mend the break between us and England. There were a lot of people that realized that there's no way we're going to mend this break. So under pressure, under duress, the ones that realized that there's no peaceful solution acquiesced to the others, and they submitted to the crown what was called the Olive Branch Petition. But it was a good idea, because those that said that there is a peaceful solution got their way in submitting this petition to England, to the crown. They got no response. Their petition was ignored. Then we had all the events that occurred in Massachusetts in 1774 all the way up to April 19, 1775. At that point, these people that thought there was a peaceful solution were really beginning to think there is no peaceful solution. So it was kind of a critical point in our history where the majority shifted and said, at whatever cost, we're going to take on the battle. Now, there were still some that hoped that there would be a peaceful solution, but that peaceful solution never came. And once the rifles were out and people were dying, the hope slowly diminished in those hardcore people that felt there was a peaceful solution. They eventually realized there is no turning back. We've got to go full steam ahead. So Randy and I kind of developed this idea. Let's develop a petition. And the logo came at the same time. We're past the point of don't tread on me. We've been trodden on so badly, it's unbelievable. The Founding Fathers never would have tolerated what we've had to in this country. Now, the reason many of us have tolerated is we are a much smaller majority at this point in time than they were then. The Olive Branch Petition was written trying to get ready for the first Tea Party. So it was kind of a rush job. So I drafted it up, sent it to Randy, went back and forth a few times cleaning it up and put it out and tried to get it out to people in time for them to make copies and get them out to their representative and two senators in their state. I don't know how many people sent them in. I sent three out to, I'm in California, so you can imagine who they went to, but I sent them out to the three offices of the representative and two senators from California. Got no response. The hope was, though, that since these were each an individual petition, that there would be a stack on the desk that all had this yellow flag that said, "You have tread on me." Well, it didn't work, but it's remained on the web page since then for people to read and understand. I even gave copies of it to some liberals that lived down the street from me, and they thought it was a good idea. So that's the background behind the You Have Tread on Me petition. If there is a possibility of a peaceful solution, it's either to get the government to acquiesce to these demands or get enough people voted into office that will agree to abide by this petition. The original, to send it to Washington and enforce it, and as Randy said earlier, it's really a demand, but it's written under the... well, we'll get into the petition now, and I've given the link there, and you can follow along and see that this is not a petition in the normal sense. Okay, Randy, which way do we go now?
Well, let's do this. I would have everybody go and open up a new tab in their browser and go to the petition page, and let's read the petition, and let's read through the beginning of the petition, you know, through the opening dialogue there. The part of it before we get into our actual demands. And then we can discuss that for a bit and talk about what it's actually saying and what it is. And then we can start going into the demands, but our demands are a little bit different, everybody. The demands we put forth in this are not just a demand, like return to gold and silver. Okay, great. You want us to return to gold and silver. Now, how do we do that? We haven't just told them what we're demanding. We're telling them how to do it. We're telling them what is going to be. And therein lies the big difference. Because everybody has demands, but nobody has a way to make them happen. Nobody has a plan to make them happen. So, that's what this whole petition was about. We not only tell them what we want, but how it's going to happen. If you leave it up to them, they'll even screw this idea up. So, I would invite everybody to go there, and let's basically start reading on the opening of the petition then.
Before we do, understand that this is federal, not state, and a lot of people at the time asked, well, what about my state? And I offered anybody that wants to prepare a petition for their state, we can look at their constitution and develop one that's specific for the state, but understanding jurisdictions are different between federal and state, and our biggest problem is with the federal. And that the states ain't going to solve the problem as long as they get federal money, that the first target has to be the federal. So, the petition, it's styled under one banner. Now, the idea was to bring everybody in under one banner. This was written after Divide and Conquer and the thoughts that went into that. It's a petition for redress of grievances, which is guaranteed in the First Amendment Constitution. This petition is directed to those who allege to represent us in the halls of Congress of the United States of America. You, who during your campaign for the votes of the people, made promises which you failed to keep. Those promises became the cause or reason for which the votes of the people were cast in your favor. It was the reliance on what you claimed to be your course that was the bond of representation that was created when those votes were cast. It is your deviation from what you campaigned for that leads us to conclude that you no longer represent the will of the people who elected you to the office that you hold. On July 4, 1776, the Declaration of Independence was formally signed. This magnificent document provides an insight into the thinking of the Founding Fathers. For example, it provides their explanation of the purpose of government, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just power from the consent of the governed. Those rights therein mentioned are enumerated as life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Clearly, they have provided us an understanding the government was instituted to serve the interests of the people, not to serve the interests of the ruler or large corporations, which concept was so prevalent in Europe. They also provide us a reason that they had taken on the formidable task of separating from England, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to effect their safety and happiness. They also explain the difficulty in coming to the point of action with the explanation, prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established shall not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. Next, they explain the obligation that they impose upon the future should events demonstrate that the government has deviated from its proper purpose. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism. It is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide for new guards for their future security. 12 years later, in 1788, the states ratified a constitution, which was the document that authorized and created a government under the authority of the people. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. The government of the United States of America is the creation of the people of the United States of America. It is not a power unto itself, rather it is a governing body, not a ruling body, which was created to manage the affairs of the government, not the affairs of the people. As a condition of ratification, the people made a call for a Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights, when ratified in 1791, was, as the Constitution preceded by a preamble, setting forth its purpose. The preamble anticipated that some of the people's concerns not addressed in the Constitution should be addressed to assure that the proper role of government be observed. It read, "The conventions of a number of the states having at the time of their adopting the Constitution expressed a desire, in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers, that further declaratory and restrictive clauses shall be added." The Bill of Rights contained two articles that are significant in light of our concerns. Article 9, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or discourage others retained by the people. Article 10, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Understanding that we are the posterity identified in the preamble to the Constitution, we come forward today to present to you the Congress of the United States of America, the creation of we the people, with demands that must be resolved by you who serve us in Washington, D.C. These demands are consistent with the Constitution and the rights retained by the states and the people. They are demands that must be met for the people to continue to allow the existence of that government created by them. Should these demands not be met by the sitting Congress, the people will conclude that this Congress no longer serves the people, and that you have, by that absence of respect for the people and their will, dissolved any obligation of respect once due you by the people. You, by your refusal to act in accordance with the Constitution, have become rebels to that Constitution and to the people. These demands are presented to you, the members of Congress, as our plea that you right yourselves by acting on our behalf. If you fail to act, you have, by that omission, dissolved the bonds that have so long bound us together. What we are demanding is that you pursue with vigor each and all of the following to fulfillment. That's the introduction. Now I got to take a breather. So, Randy, talk.
Okay. Now, what I wanted to go over on that part in the beginning section that we just went over is what it really means. Now, if you look at it, we are redeclaring, first off, free men declare their independence, their sovereignty. We are redeclaring our independence and our sovereignty in that opening statement. That is important. Second off, the entire opening section was really reminiscent of the olive branch petition submitted to the king before the Revolutionary War. This is a reminder to them of what was, what happened, and the right that we are guaranteed. that we can replace or refashion government when that government becomes destructive to the will, the liberty, the freedom, and the safety and security of the people.
Let's say rebuild instead of replace. Replace sounds like we're going to vote them in.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not looking at replacing or rebuild. And that's what we're redoing here. We're rebuilding the Constitution and our government as it was intended to be. Now, everything in here, as I mentioned before, is 100% constitutional. It's heavily referenced as well. So keep that in mind.
If you fail to act, you have, by that omission, dissolved the bonds that have so long bound us together. That means cut the government afloat. So this isn't asking them to deny or allow a mosque in New York. This is a demand that if they want our continued allegiance to the government, that they must abide by the Constitution. And as Randy pointed out on the chat, it's clearly stated the steps necessary and lawful, and that was what we're trying to do in that introduction, is to lay out what government is, what's gone wrong, and what's expected if that government's going to continue, right?
Exactly. You know, the Constitution, you know, clearly lays out the steps that are necessary in order to refashion government to meet the people's will and how to fix the government. First off, a Continental Congress, a lawful Continental Congress, had to be created. Now, what is a Continental Congress? A Continental Congress was a federal or national committee, a safety gathering, where delegates were sent from the various state committees of safety to convene.
A confederation would be the proper term, I think, there.
Confederation. And they convened. Now, if you aren't aware of what the committees of safety are, I highly recommend you go back to the archives and in my blog talk page, blogtalkradio.com/RandyMack, and go look for the two shows that Gary and I did on the committees of safety. Now, the committees of safety were the first branch of government. They were the people's government, our branch of the government, and all other governments and all other branches were subordinate to the committees of safety.
Now, understand that the royal government and all the colonies would never have considered sending their representatives to the Continental Congress. And so, Randy, I don't think was quite clear on that. The committees of safety were the ones that called for the Continental Congresses and sent delegates to the Continental Congress. The royal government would not participate.
Correct. Sorry if I misstated that. Yeah, I didn't mention the royal governor part. So that's an important part. They were not subordinate to the governor at all. Not one bit. So, now, after that, the next step the Constitution says that we have to engage in is a constitutional convention. Well, we haven't had that yet. We had a Continental Congress, but so far that hasn't even been completed yet. Now, then and only then, according to the Constitution, if I am correct in my understanding of it, which I believe I am, correct me if I'm wrong, Gary, then and only then, if the government defies the will of the Constitutional Convention, then and only then do we have the right to replace it by any and all means necessary.
Well, you said that we had a did you say that we had a Continental Congress already?
We did. A Continental Congress was convened in 2009. They wrote the Articles of Freedom.
Yes, they did, but is that a legitimate Continental Congress? Who
that would be my next, though. That was the reason for bringing up the Committees of Safety. Now, my question was that a lawfully convened Continental Congress?
And the answer is absolutely not. It was not no more representative of the people than the people that sit in Washington, D.C. The members of that Continental Congress were volunteers and did not seek representation of the people. They sought acceptance of the people that were setting up the Continental Congress. And until we have committees of safety representing large amounts of people, we are not retracing the steps of the Founding Fathers.
Yes, let us rephrase that. So the Continental Congress was not lawfully enacted. It was not representative of the people. There was no committee of safety involved. So was it lawfully enacted then? And the answer is absolutely not. I mean, kudos to them for the idea of it. But remember, we have a constitution and we must follow the laws as they are laid forth for us. And the steps must be taken specifically as they are laid out. That is the whole goal of this radio show, to create that system that we enact lawfully upon the necessary steps laid out in the Constitution. So, let's start going over the actual points there. And let's get into that now. Let's talk about what it is, how are we going to fix this, and what are some of the ideas that we're talking about. Do you want to go over that, Gary? Do you want me to read through it, or how do you want to work this?
Well, I'll do it. They're broken down into various areas of concern. And the first one is military. The three elements under military is return all combat troops to the United States within 6 months. Thank you, Obama. You're trying to do it. Devise plans for recovery of as much equipment as practical to be returned to the United States for use or for scrap. Prepare a troop withdrawal plan, including rear guard. Now, that's a touchy one, because a lot of people believe that we should be in Iraq and Afghanistan, but then they're ignoring the Constitution. The reason that was written is if we allow the government to start wars just because they want to start wars without declaring them and without laying their purpose and what their goals are, then we end up with quagmires. And we still don't know what the goal is in Afghanistan, and we still don't know what the goal is in Iraq. So unless and until Congress declares war, those troops over there are in violation of the Constitution. The only way that they can be sent without a declaration of war would be similar to what Thomas Jefferson did with the Barbary Pirates, and you could say that George Sr. did with Iraq. He went in, kicked ass, and got out. He did not extend the war forever. But Korea, we've still got troops in. Vietnam, we don't have troops in. Somalia, we don't have troops in. Lebanon, we don't have troops in. Those three that we don't have troops in, we got kind of kicked. All these other countries we have troops in. Germany, Japan still, Bosnia, Afghanistan, Iraq, whether they're combat or not. I've said combat troops in here because they are the elements of war. If they're garrison troops, they're not necessarily elements of war, and it's kind of a gray area. But to think that we are going to allow the government to declare war anytime they want, boy, if we get really mad at them, all they got to do is declare another, or not declare a war, but start another war, get the sympathy and flag-waving people in the streets on the overpasses to wave at the soldiers as they go to get in the plane, and detract from the concerns over other violations of the Constitution. We've given them the means for the tail to wag the dog. So, any questions on that one? On the military? Apparently not. So we'll go to the next one, banking. Now, this gets touchy. People want to audit the Federal Reserve. I've asked them, what good will an audit do? You know what it's going to show? It's going to show these people got filthy rich. What do you do then? Why take that step? If Congress authorized an audit today, it would probably take them 3 or 4 years to come up with the directions or the specifications for the audit. And then they probably allow 5 or 6 years for the Federal Reserve to perform the audit. And as they did, they'd be changing laws and doing everything they could to put roadblocks in to anything that would have the effect that we would expect out of an audit if it was performed on a private company. So on banking, it says stop all fractional reserve banking immediately. That means you don't loan money banks that you don't have. Create no additional currency, Federal Reserve notes, for circulation. Begin planning for greenback, full faith and credit of the United States without interest or surcharge, and gold and silver-based currencies, and plan withdrawal from the Federal Reserve Act to be accomplished within 5 years. Now, people say abolish the Federal Reserve. If you did, what would we use in the interim? What would be our means of purchasing anything during that period when we're trying to get a currency in place that we can consider constitutional and lawful? So, as Randy pointed out early on, that these are thought out to be goals rather than demands that really have no merit in themselves. You got any thoughts on the...
You're going to just shut down the Federal Reserve overnight? That will destroy it. You can't do that.
Destroy our economy.
You can't shut it down overnight. It's not going to happen. That would be idiotic and stupid.
But the if you think what would be accomplished, there would be no fractional reserve banking immediately. That means no more loans based on money that's not there. That solves one problem. Now, if the government takes $100,000 and can loan it out nine times, $900,000, say at 10% interest, they're doubling the money that they started with each year. That's why the transfer of wealth is going to the bankers, the money merchants, already. So by stopping that, we stop the flow of money to the money merchants. Creating no additional Federal Reserve notes would make a very important provision because it would forestall hyperinflation. Hyperinflation, with the first stimulus package under Bush, I think it was $700 billion in currency was printed. That is still held in Federal Reserve banks. There's a Federal Reserve Bank page that shows the money in circulation. They're showing it in circulation, but in reading enough, you'll find that they have not released it yet. The reason they haven't is because, and I equate it to a nickel candy bar. When I was a kid, a nickel candy bar cost a nickel. Now they cost a dollar. If they released all that money, candy bars would go up to $2.50 or $3. So by not allowing any more Federal Reserve notes into circulation, we would forestall the possibility of hyperinflation, which Argentina went through and many European countries went through back in the 30s. And then begin planning for greenback, full faith and credit of the United States, without interest or surcharge, and gold and silver-based currencies. Now, provisions have to be made so that gold and silver do not leave the country under any circumstances, so that might require amending treaties to say that you will only have credit in the United States if we have an imbalance of trade, but that you will not take our gold and silver from us. Greenback dollars is probably the best thing, and some might consider it the only good thing that Abraham Lincoln ever did. But rather than going to the banks and borrowing money at interest, he printed greenback dollars that would retire as they return to government in the form of taxes, fees, contributions, or any other form. They were not fiat currency. We've been living with fiat currency since 1968. Plan withdrawal from the Federal Reserve Act to be accomplished within 5 years. That would allow time for everything to be put in order to make a smooth transition to a stable economy that would not be supporting the elite and destroying us. So any questions on that one? I see a lot of conversation, but no questions. Okay. So let's go to immigration.
Actually, I do have a couple of questions on that one
okay.
now.
Okay, let's go.
I want to talk about this economic aspect here a little bit because this is a vitally important one and one that most people today can relate to. Now let's talk about this, okay? What happens when we end the fractional reserve banking? We don't put any more Federal Reserve currency notes out there. and we basically have to recreate another form of currency. How is that going to affect us, and how can that play out? I mean, and what would we base this currency on? You know, so if you wouldn't mind, let's spend about 5 minutes on that, talking about that for a minute, kind of spell that out so people really get a grasp of that, because that's going to be one of the scariest aspects to this. People are going to be afraid of their money. They're going to be afraid of their money.
Well, first, by stopping Federal Reserve banking, fractional banking, what you do is you, all of a sudden, banks have no money to loan. That means that you can't go down to the bank and borrow money to buy a house. Doesn't mean that you can't go to the guy that wants to sell a house and do a mortgage for deed and go back to the methods that were used back in the past to sell property. It wasn't until after World War II and the GI Bill that the nature of buying property changed to what we have today. Before then, you saved up a substantial amount, or you bought raw land and built a house, raw land being cheaper than buying a house, or a farm or a ranch, or you found somebody that had, say, a house or a ranch that he didn't want anymore. He was retiring and his kids didn't want it, or he didn't have any kids, and he said, okay, I'll give you a mortgage to deed, and I'll sell it to you for $20,000. You pay me $1,000 a year for 20 years. And if you keep good faith in that and don't default, then it's yours, and if you default, it comes back to me in its entirety. So there was pressure in that to keep your obligation up, but there's no reason that we can't give individual credit ourselves. When I was a kid, there was a place called the General Store in Rolling Hills, and they still had what they called the markup book. Now, my mother wasn't a member of it. We paid cash for things, but there were a lot of families that had been there for years, and they'd go in the store, and they'd buy a bunch of groceries, and they'd tally up the total and say, do you want to mark that up? And they'd say yes, so they'd open the book, their page, and write the amount in. If they came in and made a payment, they'd write it off. So it doesn't mean credit disappears. It means credit doesn't go through the banks. And we can get used to the idea of giving credit. I've just sold a truck I had for $2,000, and I told the guy $50 a month, but if you don't make a payment, he doesn't have a job. Now, if you don't make a payment, no sweat. We'll just hold it off until the next one. And so I'll get my $2,000, and he'll have a truck to drive, and that'll help him to get a job if he can find one. But banks are going to send out the repo guy if you default on a payment. And they have every right to, because they own the car. But in this case, I transferred title to him because I trust him. I could have held title for a little more security, but it's a guy I've known for a long time. So there are means for us to acquire things, but it's going back to the methods that were used prior to the whole change in the nature of debt, which came at the end of World War II. When they first started credit cards, May Company, Buffum, Sears, J.C. Penney's had credit cards. They were only good for those stores. And you paid monthly, or they would carry it for a while so you could buy your Christmas presents. But most people back then would join a Christmas club and actually make money before Christmas rather than lose money after Christmas. But then the proliferation came. MasterCard, I think, was the first one. Well, no, gas companies had credit cards that were only good in their station. Standard included Chevron and a few others. Shell had theirs. Mobil had theirs. But they were only good at their stations. So it was not much different than what the general store had in the markup, except it was a little more sophisticated. It wasn't electronic. They imprinted a metal card or a raised lettered card, and it transferred to a carbon piece of paper, and then you signed it, and you got a receipt, and they kept the card part and sent it in, and it went against your bill. No reason those things can't happen again, because the bank isn't involved. But when you get to MasterCard, Visa, American Express and all these others, that's where the banks are making money. And they charge high rates. Now, back then, these people might charge 1% or 1.5% a year. Most credit cards now, back in Jimmy Carter's days, a lot of states repealed their usury laws. Florida, I think, was 8.5%. Anything over 8.5% was considered usury. They had to get rid of that law. And so now we've got all over the country credit cards charging 20-25%. It's almost as bad as in the Army, where you could borrow 10 for 15 on payday from the loan sharks. So you get away with that. The merchant wants to sell his gasoline. He's going to give you the best deal he can to get you to come into his gas station. A merchant wants you to buy groceries there. They're going to give you the best deal they can to get you to come in and buy groceries there. So there's not a large amount of profit. So by getting rid of the fractional banking system and not having those electronic dollars available, we will see an immediate change that will require some adjustment. But as we adjust to it, we'll find that it's not much different and a lot less expensive than the system we've got now. Next question.
Gary, I think we have a caller on the line. Do you want to take a call real quick?
Yeah, let's take the call.
Area code 937.
Oh, okay, Randy. How are you doing?
Good. How are you doing? Did you have a question or a comment or anything so far?
Yes. Actually, I had a comment backpedaling a little bit to what you said about limiting the Federal Reserve with the production of money. I do agree with everything you're saying, but I did have a concern about that one comment.
Okay.
If you did limit the Federal Reserve and their production of new currency, what would keep them from recalling all the outstanding debts, though? Wouldn't that plunge us into chaos?
Not necessarily. The reason for the transition, and we haven't really got there yet, that was next on the agenda, so thanks for calling up the next item on the agenda. The problem with coming out with greenback and or gold silver-based currency initially is, how much do we have to make? How many dollars do we have to have? Eventually, we're going to have to buy back the Federal Reserve notes, right?
Right. Well, we have to.
Well,
we have to destroy inflation. Right now, with debt equaling our money supply, it's a parasitic entity, and a parasitic entity that feeds off of itself can only exist for so long. Its destruction is inevitable. So stopping the new amount of new production of currency by the Federal Reserve is very important. But by doing so with our current economy, if we don't have an immediate transplant, then we're doomed ourselves.
So let me ask if you believe the stimulus and the TARP programs are good for our economy. Do you feel that they're good for the economy?
Yes.
Roosevelt tried that. He tried buying us out of debt, and the Depression didn't end until the war production. It was 1942 or 43 before the Depression was over, 13 years after it started.
Right.
We had seven major depressions before the Great Depression. The government stayed out of all of them, and they solved themselves in two or three years. Now, when the government gets involved, they're bailing out the banks. They're bailing out the people with a lot of money. They're not helping you or me. Now, if we stop creation of additional Federal Reserve notes, we stop inflation right there.
Of course.
If they call their
we
notes back, then we issue greenback dollars one for one for all of them. But until we know how many to issue. Now, think of where money is. I mean, you've seen pictures of closets filled with American $100 bills in Mexico from these drug cartels. Why should we replace those? So we need a replacement program. If you're an American citizen and have dollars, you can return, exchange those directly for greenback dollars. We have to set up what criteria is used. If some guy that doesn't speak English comes in and has $26 million, we're not going to honor that to him. You know, we tell him, that Federal Reserve notes, you go see the Federal Reserve. Your gripe is with them. In fact, interestingly, what would happen if China says, you owe us $30 billion Federal Reserve notes? Well, Federal Reserve, they just moved to London, but go talk to them, because those notes you have their name on it, not ours, not the United States of America. They have Federal Reserve Bank on it. So,
all right. I understand. I do completely back you on going back to greenbacks, but logistically, the problem that I see is if that's something that would have to be put in production immediately, and what would before the actual law went into effect. If it did, what would keep the Federal Reserve from acting before that?
Well, what would the Federal Reserve do? Say, turn in your dollars quickly to the bank? If you had a bank book, if you had a balance in the bank, that would be honored. If you had cash in your pocket, that would be honored. There's no way the Federal Reserve can take the money out of your wallet. They might be able to take it out of your bank account, but if you've got a record of what your bank account was, that could be honored with the greenbacks. Now, the more money they print, the more we're going to see inflation. The reason for stopping it, because they could dump that $600 trillion that remains. When I read last, 7% of the $700 billion was put into circulation. So that's, what, about $49 billion. The problem
actually,
is, if that hits the market...
Of it's only physical.
Pardon?
Actually, only 5% of it's actually physical, too. And a lot of that that you were just talking about is overseas.
Well, the thing to do is we've got to keep it from going into into the economy, into circulation, to avoid inflation. If we did not have that step, the Federal Reserve could dump all that. It's already been authorized. They're not releasing it because they're afraid of the consequences if the release is too great. If they were allowed to release that, nickel candy bars would be $2.50 or $3, and it would be destructive to our economy. And if they released it and got something in kind in return for it, that means that the greenbacks might be going to them, and we don't want to give them $650 billion worth of greenbacks.
Oh, of course not.
So I don't see that there's anything beneficial to allowing additional Federal Reserve notes into circulation. Anything that would happen along that line would be destructive. I think, and you know, from what you've said, I don't see any change in that.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, I didn't want to interrupt. I'm sorry. I just had a quick comment and it turned into
not a problem at all. This is what we're trying to do: get people to understand exactly what it is we're talking about, so they understand what is going on and what we're actually trying to do.
Excellent. Well, thank you, gentlemen.
Not a problem. No, but let's think about this for a minute. Though we had a central, you know, we had a central bank with Lincoln and with Kennedy, and they were both talking about doing this exact same thing. So this isn't something new that we're just pulling out of our, you know, just pulling out of thin air here. This was the plan before.
And cause and effect were considered in coming to these solutions, as I just explained to you, by stopping the... If we don't stop the introduction into circulation of Federal Reserve notes, we have, in a sense, done exactly what happened in 1933 when gold was outlawed to be owned by people, but not by corporations, and it went from $20 an ounce to $32 an ounce, or a 60% increase in value overnight. If they were to dump those $600 billion, those would now become obligations for greenbacks. As long as the Federal Reserve holds them, they're not obligations for greenbacks. So that's $600 billion in greenbacks that don't have to be issued. So unless somebody can explain why it would be beneficial for those to come into circulation, if anybody has a reason, you know, can explain why they should be allowed into circulation, I'd like to hear it. I can overlook something. Randy can overlook something.
Well, they got a caller on. Maybe they've got an idea here on this.
Let's see.
All right.
Oh, caller, you're on the air.
All right, I wanted to know, because I just got here, I wanted to know what the solution, or the proposed solution was, because the show name is Time for a Solution, so I wanted to know what it was.
We're actually discussing that whole thing right now. This is the first show of that solution.
Are you on the chat?
No.
If you go to www.outpost-of-freedom.com, and then right near the top you'll see you have Tread on Me petition. Hit that link. Then go down to the second link on that page that says petition, and hit that link. And if you read fast, you'll catch up with us in no time. Now, what
How about
we're talking
giving me
about,
the nice encapsulated version in about 2 seconds?
Pardon me?
How about giving me the nice encapsulated version in about 2 seconds? You have solutions to tyranny. I'm sure it can be summed up in about a sentence.
We'll encapsulate it. And where we began, and I'm sure nobody will mind because this is, a new concept to most people. This all began with, is there a peaceful solution? And for years, I'd asked the question of people, and nobody had one. And then Randy and I, about a year and a half ago, got talking and realized that we'd never asked ourselves that question. So we started thinking, is there a peaceful solution? Well, yes. We model it after the Olive Branch Petition that was the concession to the people that wanted to go to war and get rid of, separate from England, and those that wanted to reconcile with England. The Olive Branch Petition was sent to London. It was ignored. And so those people that felt that there was a peaceful solution realized that there was none.
Mm-hmm.
People today believe the election will change things. I've been following it for nearly 20 years, and I've seen nothing change, and I don't know that it's going to change this November.
Okay, can I interrupt?
This becomes a demand, and we're going through the demands. It would have to be completed by Congress if we were to retain our relationship with the Congress, the existing government.
All right, so what you're saying is to have a petition, mainly about to redress grievances, much akin to the Declaration of Independence, submitted to Congress, who are the foxes that are in charge of the hen house, hope that they don't laugh at it, and then proceed from there.
I don't care if they laugh at it or not. In fact, I would expect that they will do exactly what the King and Parliament did, laugh at it.
Right.
Now, the people that signed the petition and realized that this is a peaceful solution, nothing is inconsistent with the Constitution. All of it is obligations on Congress in accordance with the Constitution, that if people get on board and sign this petition, and then they're laughed at, then they're not going to go down in the streets with the sign that, in the Federal Reserve or anything anymore. So it's as much to put the demand on Congress, and if they acquiesce and say, we'll do it, that's great. We've solved the problem. But if they don't, those people that see the petition, believe in the petition, sign the petition, send their copies in, if they're shunned by Congress, maybe they'll begin to realize that those guys in Washington, D.C. are not going to solve the problem anyway.
No, well, they're not.
More importantly than that, though, the rest of this show, this is only the first show of the new series about the plan.
Oh, all right. Can I get my suggestion?
Point through the things that we need to do, the things that we need to implement that are lawful, that the Constitution lays out is the only solution to fixing our problems.
All right.
And that's what we begin doing as well. We start laying out those foundations. We start creating them.
Okay.
We start doing what the Constitution says is lawful for us to do.
All right. Is mass education part of your process?
Yes, it is. Massive part of it.
Okay, because that's what's necessary, because the electorate, or let's say the vote the bums out, that is or could be an effective solution, a peaceful solution, if people didn't vote out Democrats to put in Republicans and then vote out Republicans to put in Democrats. I've told people, just vote in an independent.
Exactly. We get mad at one, and they know we're going to be mad at the Democrats, so they put up who they want to be the Republican next, and we'll push the next step of the agenda.
Yeah,
that's your politics system, that goes away.
Yeah,
you know, we people become much smarter than that through massive amounts of education. But the rest of the document spells out recourse that we're going to be talking about as well.
Oh, okay. Good.
That we're going to be implementing, as well as the creation of things like the committees of safety. We need those in order to convene a lawful Continental Congress. The one that happened in 2009 wasn't ordered to be convened by the committees of safety, because there are none. We need to begin to create the lawful systems for which the Constitution says we can engage in to take back our country.
Do you have a deadline for setting up your goals? Because my concern is that 2012 is the critical point in America's history.
And well, you know what? Safety can be set up in less than an hour. So, you know, my goal then would be to have you, after we get off this show, possibly get in touch with us, talk to us for a little bit, and then have you set up a committee of safety in about the next hour after that.
Mm-hmm.
If we can get people to do that, then we're off to a great start.
I think a good start would be if you go back on the You Have Tread on Me page, Randy's page, not the one with the petition, and go back to the two radio programs we did on committees of safety earlier, if you're not familiar with them, and get an idea of what the committees of safety were. Very briefly, in about 93 or 94, I was scratching my head, wondering, how did the Founding Fathers get everything together? And so I started reading some older history books and realized the Committee of Safety were fundamental and instrumental, and without them we would never have had the United States of America to begin with. And it would allow for a peaceful transition of government, not of power. The power was transition was affected by the Revolutionary War, but the peaceful transition of government from a royal government to the Congress of the United States, the Articles of Confederation, and subsequently the Constitution, was very peaceful. And I don't think there's another country in the world that went through a political change with as little impedance as what we had. You know, it was, quite frankly, it was a miracle that there could be a political transition that went so smoothly. So, reading that on Committee of Safety, but yes, Randy and or I are always willing to spend time with anybody who wants to set up a Committee of Safety, and we'll do everything we can. If you go to www.committee.org, you'll find a lot of documents that are from the past and some comments on what effect it can have on us today and some ideas on how to set it up. We don't have the plan on how to set it up. It was understood back then how to set them up because it's a part of English heritage and tradition that goes back to the Magna Carta.
All right, what's the name of the website again?
Committee.org.
Committee.org, okay.
C-O-M-M-I-T-T-E-E.org.
Okay, good.
Now,
okay.
For the radio programs, you'd have to go to Randy's page, which... Randy, what's your URL for your page?
The Blog Talk page where the show is at, where the show is streamed from, it's at Blog Talk Radio. It's www.blogtalkradio.com/Randy Mack. And I'm going to start, my website is www.youhavetreadonme.com. Our chat room and the show is broadcast from there also, and I'm going to begin populating that entire website with committee of safety info and other info as we progress with each show, so we can get up there with each show, and then you can start looking through it and start implementing.
But if you find the two archive programs on Committee of Safety and go to the committee.org page and read that, I think you'll get a good insight of what they forgot to tell you in history class.
All right, well, I have to get off the air now, so good luck. All right, guys?
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay.
Appreciate
Bye-bye.
It.
Bye-bye.
I think, did we cover everything? The only one remaining is planned for a Federal Reserve Act to be accomplished within 5 years. That allows that transition that we've been talking about. That was a timely call because that was the next step. Do you think we've covered banking sufficiently, Randy?
Yeah, we covered the banking and everything sufficiently. We've got about half an hour left, so you know, we can probably get through, we might even be able to get through a good chunk of this. If not, we can cover it on the next Tuesday show and then continue on with the committees of safety and things like that as well.
And militia and
the militia and everything else that goes with that.
Okay, number three is immigration. There shall be a moratorium. Well, a little background first. I think it was the mid-90s, all of a sudden there was a drastic change in the immigration policy in this country, and it was the soft, warm, fuzzy stuff. And I'm not going to say liberal or conservative, progressive or Democrat or Republican or anything, because to me, they're all going the same place. It's just they want it to be exactly like they want it. But there was a big change in the immigration policy. They had the first amnesty. Illegals who had been here 5 years or more, had broken the law longer, were given green cards. Those that hadn't been here 5 years, they had to go back home if they got caught. But I don't think they sent many back. But before then, there were quotas on immigration. There were qualifications on education. There were emergency situations. But putting those aside, there were qualifications on education or training. There were limitations. The quotas set on various countries. There were a number of things that are I've just been put by the wayside. So in immigration, there shall be a moratorium on immigration for 5 years to provide sufficient time for an assessment of what the role of immigration and immigrants is to our country. We need to reevaluate what has been done, the damage that's been done. Now, a good example is back in the early 1900s when immigrants came here, and with the quotas, they assimilated. They became Americans. But when you allow massive amounts of integration and massive amounts from certain countries, you start getting intrusions into the American way of life. They don't want to assimilate. They create their own communities, and then they start imposing what they believe to be the proper form of government before they've even learned what our free form of government is supposed to be. So that assimilation process can only be accomplished. I'm not much of a cook, but I know if I dump the flour in the boiling water, I'm going to get lumps. If I sprinkle it in slowly and stir as I do, I'll get a nice, smooth base. And immigration is the same way. If you throw a bunch in at one time, you get lumps. And those lumps don't want to assimilate because they can reestablish their culture and then start pushing out and saying, you have to accept our culture. If I cut my wife's head off, you have to accept that I did that for religious reasons, and you can't prosecute me. So assimilation is a necessary aspect if we are going to retain the nature of what this country was intended to be. Absent that assimilation, all is lost. It is not going to be, it's not now what it was when I was a kid, but it's going to be far worse in another generation. It's going to be unbelievable. It's beyond our conception at this point. So unless and until we come up with a good plan for immigration, we're only hurting ourselves and destroying our country. Existing immigration laws regarding into the country will be rigidly enforced. So any laws existing now that allow any immigration will be enforced. Now, that includes visas. You got a six-month visa, you tell us where you are. The day that you don't, that you move and don't inform us where you've moved to is the day we track you down and ship you back to where you came from. Your visa is over when you violate it. We need rigid enforcement. What good are laws if they're not enforced? After a while, people realize that, hey, well, it doesn't really matter. Surprisingly, a number of the Branch Davidians that died in Waco, Texas, were overstayed on their visas. The ones that didn't get burned up by the government that were outside that I met had been, some of them, 2 or 3 years beyond a six-month visa. But in talking with them, they said everybody does it. Our immigration policy has been non-existent. We have laws we don't enforce. Those have to be enforced. If we don't keep an absolute control on who we allow into our country, as much as if you had a party on Saturday night and you started getting people you didn't know and you didn't want in, you close the door on them. Don't let them in. We should be the same in our country. We've got to close the door to keep the party the way it's intended to be. Enforce border conditions to prohibit such illegal entry of people and objects. Now, right now, there are private citizens in at least three groups working in the Arizona borders trying to discourage illegal immigration. The government is doing nothing unless they try and sneak across one of the drive-through checkpoints. But we've got the Arizona Citizens Militia, the Coalition of Patriots, and the Arizona Territorial Militia, the three groups that I'm aware of, that are doing what they can to discourage that illegal immigration. They're not getting paid for it, but we're paying taxes and the government isn't doing their job. So there has to be something done on the border, even if it's participation, paid participation by volunteers, to make sure that that line is adhered to by those people that want to come across illegally. Now, here's one that I think is very important, and surprisingly, most countries, especially third world countries, adhere to this in some respect. The ownership of land within the boundaries of the United States shall be limited to citizens of the United States or by corporations authorized by the United States or the states. Ownership of land outside of those described shall be prohibited by law after 5 years. That means if a foreign corporation owns or a foreign individual owns land in this country, they have 5 years to get rid of that land and get out. We cannot allow our country to be owned by foreigners. It only makes sense. You're not going to sell part of your house to somebody and let them move in and snuggle in next to you. And if this country, if there's any way of vesting in this country, it's land ownership. Those are the people that are going to be the most careful about what happens to the country. Now, we can go back to the 70s and 80s when they came up with FHA 235 housing, which means if you only made $200 towards housing, and you know their formula to make to buy a house, but the house would cost $400 a month, the government will throw in $200, and you throw in your $200, and you get to own the house. Well, when people don't own their house, or when it's given to them free like that, they don't take care of it. You could see it in neighborhoods where people don't own their homes, where their rentals, they just degenerate. The lawns go brown. The landscaping all dies. Countries can do the same thing. Unless there's pride in ownership, there's not going to be a respect for the house, the property, the land, the country. So I think that we should take, I honestly think that we should take a course that allows only ownership of the physical United States by people who are here and citizens of the United States. So somebody that come in and acquired citizenship after 7 years could not buy land until he had acquired that citizenship and shown his faith and allegiance to this country. So that's all on immigration. Questions on that?
Any questions on the immigration aspect, which I fully support? You know, think about this. You know, if you look at Canada or the U.S. right now, you know, I'm actually in Canada right now, so let's take a look at Canada right now. There is a massive flood of immigration coming here, mainly from third world countries, very select third world countries to be more precise. And the people that come here might be very qualified for various fields. And that's fine. They come here and they engage in areas that are needed in. My question, though, is first is, why aren't we giving those jobs or training people of Canada or the U.S. for those jobs? Second off, the problem with immigration, though, also comes in when they bring in all of the family members that come with them. Grandparents, great-grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, brothers, sisters, nieces, and everybody ends up on welfare. Or on your public health care system like Canada has right now. If you take a look at the Canadian health care system, it is in dire, dire, dire straits for many different reasons. One of them is the massive immigration influx coming in. So, you know, there are some ideas there. Now, if people are going to immigrate here, fine and well. Let people immigrate here, but have them be a vital and integral part of our society. Have them assimilate in and become part of our society. Not leeching off of our society and sending all their money home and maintaining allegiances elsewhere and then taking their wealth and going back home and using us as a stepping stone. But let it be because they want to be American. That's all I got to say.
Okay, any questions on the chat? Any questions in call-ins? Well, we'll move right along to religion. Religion used to not be a problem in this country. It's very basic. I mean, for years, people kept telling me this is a Christian nation, and I told them, this is not a Christian nation. This is a nation of Christian people. The Judeo-Christian values that we adopted, both out of English common law and instituted in this country and that have applied for most of 200 years, are Judaic value. We don't believe in beheading people. We don't believe in stoning people. We basically have a concept of morality that may not be appropriate in other countries, but it was and should still be appropriate here. For centuries, we have allowed religious displays on public property. Now, public is an interesting word. Verbicide is the change of the meaning of a word to have the effect of the change of the intent of a law or a belief. Public means the people. It does not mean the government. And that needs to be understood, that public does not mean the government. It means the people. Public lands belong to all of us. They don't belong to the government. The government's only the caretaker of our land. A public park belongs to all the people within that jurisdiction. It doesn't belong to the city government or the county government. It belongs to the people. The county government or the city government is nothing more than a caretaker. How can they put up a fence and say, you can't come in this public park after 6 o'clock in the evening? There's something wrong when the government is allowed to steal words like that. So let's get into religion. It is to be understood that public is the people, not the government. That any religious displays on public property cannot be restricted or prohibited by government action. I was raised, every Christmas, people said Merry Christmas. Some would throw out a Happy Hanukkah. There was Santa Claus. There were religious displays. Nativity scenes were all over. We've abandoned that moral happiness, the cheerfulness of the season that comes with Christmas, over fear that we'll be arrested for doing what has been done in this country for most of 200 years. There's something wrong with that. Next, any laws previously enacted which limit religious practices, holidays, displays, or exercises shall be immediately repealed. Finally, the Christian religion, having been fundamental to the creation of this country, shall have preference over all other religions in any matter where a conflict might arise. Three, that's religion, so throw the questions out. Randy, you awake?
I'm here. I'm looking to see if there's any questions. We have people saying that the Muslim religion is needs to go. I'm basically reminding people though that the actual Muslim religion is based upon the first five books. The Quran is based upon is the first five books of the Old Testament, same as the Torah, the Jewish book. They're the same religion. Now, the problem arose, though, with the twisting of Muhammad's words by a government or a theocratic government system. They have a theocratic government system, government of religious rule. Now, our government took the basis of freedom and twisted that completely and turned us into authoritarianism. And that political system did the exact same thing with their religion. You were right, though. The Judaic culture moved past the stoning, move past the death sentences and things like that, whereas the Muslim religion did not. But they also have the exact same foundation, basis, and belief. In fact, the Muslims practice the laws of kosher just as, probably even more heavily than most Jews do today. So, we've got to remember that, though. My personal belief is that the problems that we're having with Islam today or the Muslims, is a problem of our government's foreign policy, as well as a twisting of that religious faith system for a government's political end.
Islam having preference over the Christian religion? Yes. Which is why that third item was in there. The Christian religion, having been fundamental to the creation of this country, shall have preference over all other religions in any matters where a conflict might arise. So I think that solves the problem. Now, I don't want to go into personal thoughts, but to me, Islam is not a religion. It's a political and social theory as well, and they're integrated. They go hand in hand. If I were discussing immigration, I would have serious concerns about whether Muslims should even be allowed in this country, because it is a social and a religious and a political theory. It's not just a religion like Christianity. We have moral values, but they're not. We don't have ecclesiastic courts anymore. We got rid of them. We don't allow we allow religious people to hold office, but not as religious people, only as representatives of the people. If we had imams in office, they would say that you have to, they would dictate the law, which is what they do. They don't, it's not a democratic process. It's thou shalt not, you'll lose your hand if you steal something. But to solve the religious problem, we need to get back to where we were and understand that this is a nation of Christian values.
You know, that comes from culture, too, as well. You know, and, you know, this is one of the areas that Gary and I do disagree in. And like I tell people everywhere, you know, Gary and I do not see eye to eye on everything. And I'm actually glad for that. I like diversity of ideas out there. You know, but I've read the Quran. I've read it. I've read the writings of Muhammad as well. I think a lot of it is taken out of context and twisted by government, you know, but I believe that if we're going to have a free country, we should have freedom of religion. And if somebody wants to come to America and assimilate into America and become an American, but they want to worship as they please, who am I to tell them they cannot do that? You know, I believe that Zionist Christians are just as dangerous as Zionist Muslims. They're just as dangerous. Any fanatical religious organization scares the hell out of me.
Well, Randy, you understand my personal feeling about Islam.
I do understand that.
But let's go to item three in religion. The Christian religion, having been fundamental to the creation of this country, shall have preference over all other religions in any matters where a conflict might arise. Is there any problem with that, though? And that's why this was written this way, because it accepts your condition. That would allow Muslims in here.
Well, no, I get that part too, but now my point here on that one is, and this is where my ideas come in here, and this is part of that area here. You know, what happens if, like you said, public lands mean the people's land, so if we want to put up religious icons or whatever it is there, we can do that. Well, what if somebody wants to put up a Muslim icon on public land, and they're an American citizen? And then the Christians come in and say, oh, that's detrimental to my religion, it's harmful, so therefore...
No, it's not in conflict, though, is it?
Precedent priority over it.
It's not in
and
conflict.
And therefore, Muslims could not put up whatever they wanted either.
No, it's not in conflict.
Or the Jews.
It's not in conflict. It's only where conflict arises. Now, where does conflict arise? How about this guy up in the Northeast somewhere that cut his wife's head off and he claims Sharia law allows him to do it, and the courts are really considering letting him get off because he had religious foundation for what he did? How about wearing the face scarf that women do? Those things are in conflict with us. If we require photographs,
I agree with aspects of that. You know, if I walk into a bank with my face covered, I don't think that's a good idea, anyways. But hey, if you don't do anything wrong, then so be it. But if I can't do it, why should they get a free pass? And I agree with that. I agree with those aspects. My fear, though, is that. Again, this is one of those areas that could be twisted and corrupted like we always see.
It can, but right now it is corrupted. It's corrupted to our detriment, and that's the problem we have in this country today. Go down to the public park, the courthouse, and put up a religious display.
Well, any religious display. I agree with that. If you want to put up a religious display on public property, great, so be it. It does not break my leg nor harm my field. Jefferson said that. I don't care if a man worships one god or 100 gods. I don't care. But my fear is that somebody out there, whether they be Christian, Judaic, or Muslim, will find some way to twist that. And since it gives preference to the Christian aspect of it, it will lie heavily with the Christians to be able to corrupt that, the whole intention of it. And that's what I fear. You know, I fear a Zionist Christian just as much as I fear any other Zionist out there. Because it's just another form of totalitarianism.
I see. EQ posted something that is not appropriate to this discussion, but I take umbrage with. Maybe we'll get
to it. These are areas that we need to discuss more. You know, these are areas, you know, and this is the touchy part. You know, who knows? Maybe one day I might agree with it if I can be convinced somehow that it could not be twisted, you know, that aspects like that could not be twisted. That's the only part of this entire document that I would concern myself with at all, to be honest with you.
Well,
only because I've seen how everything gets twisted already.
How do you untwist it, though, without taking these steps, these three?
Well, through assimilation, and if we actually get rid of the special interest groups and all of that other, all those other aspects, like this government, like this document and everything else proposes, we won't have those problems anymore. There will be no special interest and lobbyist groups attacking our congressmen and our state elected elected representatives in the state level, the county level. So who, what influence are they going to have to promote one agenda or the other? Then it just goes back to you worship whoever the hell you want. And if you do something that infringes upon my freedom, then you are in violation of the law.
I have
and
no
you shall
problem
be punished
with
accordingly.
That.
What's that?
I have no problem with that. But we need to be able to maintain our traditional values, the ones that existed 30 years ago, not the ones that exist today.
Agreed, and I fully support that. I believe that Americans should have their own culture. We do not need to be diversified, like they say. We need to be Americans. You know, again, I go back to the African American, the Hispanic American, the Asian American. No.
They're
get rid
American.
Of the hyphenated American, and we're all Americans. And if you don't want to be an American, well, there's hundreds of other countries to choose from. Go take your pick and go be what you choose to be.
Well,
but if you're in America and you're a citizen, you're an American. You know, and I love Italian food. So thank you, Italians, for coming here and bringing your food. I've had a lot of Middle Eastern food, and you know what? It's good stuff. So thank you for bringing that as well. But also, thank you for assimilating and learning my culture and becoming part of the U.S. and learning my language. And if you can't do that, then you can also go back home.
Okay, I see we've got about 9 minutes left, and we're coming into government authority, which is rather extensive and is going to warrant a lot of discussion.
So, yeah, I think so as well. Well, I'll tell you what, let's just spend the next 9 minutes then just kind of clearing, just kind of recapping or whatever. You know, let's talk about the constitutional ways that the, or the way that the Constitution lawfully lays out for us to
let's talk in
control of our government.
Just for a moment about rights, because what I had mentioned, DQ had said, is an understanding of rights. What are rights? It's an interesting question because we've got civil rights acts and all these other things. Well, the rights protected by the Constitution, any and all of them, do not impose on you at all, with the exception of the right to a trial by jury, because it would require that other people come to be jurors in your trial. So the only one of the rights protected by the Constitution that involves other people is the right to trial by jury. Now, when we look at rights, though, and we look at civil rights, all of a sudden, if I have to acquiesce to another person because they have a civil right, then it's to my detriment, whatever it might be. Now, you might say, well, it's not fair that you feel that way, but then that's taking away from my right to live my life as I see fit. And political correctness addresses rights pretty drastically. I'm going to use one of the objects of concern today in trying to demonstrate this. The word gay was commonly used 200 years ago to mean somebody happy, jovial. John Burgoyne was considered a gay man. Not a queer, but a gay man, because he was very happy. He wrote plays. He loved to dance and sing. There are a lot of people like that. But if you look in the definition, say 20 years ago, 30 years ago, of gay, it meant happy, jovial, carefree. But there were other words, homosexual, homo, faggot, and queer, that represented people that had sexual orientations that were other than what is considered normal by the Judeo-Christian values. In fact, the Old Testament, I think, says that if a man sleepeth with a man as if he were a woman, he should be stoned to death. So we don't stone people to death anymore, but still it's an abnormal or an aberration or an immoral consequence. So when they were called queers, they tended to stay in the closet. Let's be frank. I had a couple good friends over the years. One guy I used to ride in parades with when I was a kid was a queer. We were good friends for years until I went in the Army. Another guy, after I moved up to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Somebody had given me his name when I got. They knew I was moving to Pittsburgh, and so I called the guy, and we got to know each other. He was a nice guy. He helped me find a nice place to live and everything. He was queer. He never tried to impose himself on me. I helped him. He helped me. We were good friends. They were in the closet. They didn't. They weren't aggressive, assertive, or anything else. But now, when you take something that's queer and that means not quite normal, that's not denigrating them, really. It's a recognition of where they fit in the moral scheme of things when we look at our society as a whole. But when they're allowed to use the word gay, all of a sudden we put a positive on what used to, a very strong positive, let me say, on what used to be a minor negative. If you use faggot, it was probably a major negative, but faggot is in the dictionary. But to give them gay and give them rights creates a loss to all of us because it destroys our moral values. And it's even worse when it's imposed in the schools, and the schools then teach that having two mommies or two daddies is not a bad thing. In fact, it's probably promoted more in a positive manner than the monogamous marriage situation that's been traditional in this country for 200 years. So when we talk about rights, we've got to look at the consequence on other people. If it affects other people, it's not really rights. They call it rights, but it's privileges to those at the detriment of others. So when you use the term, just like the word public, the word rights has been abused to the point that we don't understand what rights really are. Rights cannot have an effect on other people unless they make it affect them. Privileges will affect other people just by their very existence, because what they're doing is elevating one, and when that one elevates, the other one detriments.
Well, I agree with you there, and, you know, that's something we need to look at. You know, I personally don't care. Remember, again, when a state has its own power to make its own laws, and if the people of the state want to accept gay marriage, then so be it. If the state doesn't, then so be that. That's the people's will. And no matter the decision, if you don't like whatever way that decision goes, you have now also have your freedom to engage in the vote of feet. That was always your power. Move to the state whose laws you do like.
And get the federal government out of our lives.
You know, that's what it all comes down to, whether the issue is abortion or whatever. Federal government needs to get out of our lives, and it needs to become a state issue again. And if you don't like the laws of your state, then you move. And if enough people begin to move, the state might change its views on some of those laws.
Well, actually, it should go down to the local level, the city and the county as well. And
exactly true. I mean, Lynchburg,
not direct harm to another person, they should be state or city or county laws. So
exactly.
This community doesn't want queers living in it, and they enact a law that says no queers shall live here, if you keep it hidden, that's fine. But if you get caught, don't ask, don't tell. If you get caught, we don't want you in our community. We don't want you tainting our children to believe that your living relationship is a proper thing. But the other county next door, when I was a kid, Alpine County, California, tried to entice all these queers to move up there and create a queer community. Well, there are a number of queer communities around the country now, and that's fine. They have laws that might not let normal couples live there. That's fine with me. I don't want to live there. So
why would you want to live there? Move.
It's not even the state level. It has to be the local level, because I shouldn't have to move 300 miles when I can move 30 miles if I can find a group of people that have the same moral values and want the same moral laws enforced in my community.
Very true. Like, you're right. You know, we need to take it back down to the county level. Like, you know, in fact, that's all how it's always been. You know, what your county outlaws might not be what another county outlaws. So, we're down to our last about 45 seconds. I want to thank everybody for coming on. We didn't get to go through the entire document, so we will continue that on next Tuesday's show. And we will then begin to lay out some of the foundational work for the things that we must implement in order to begin building the basis for us to take back our government, our country, our freedom. If you have any questions in the meantime, email Gary or myself. We're always happy to answer any questions. We're always happy to help out. If you'd like to start talking about a committee of safety right away, get in touch with us. If you're not sure where we are, go back and listen to the two shows that Gary and I did about the committees of safety and start learning. That would be the first step. So thank you, everybody, for tuning in, and we will talk to you soon. Next Sunday's show, Survival Sunday, and everything else. We're going to have a great lineup again coming to you, and we'll talk to you then. Be safe. Be free. Bye-bye.